be doing something that provides you the opportunity, we'll announce this later this week, to have an electronic version of your paper version of vaccination. It's not a passport, not a requirement. It's just the ability now to have an electronic version of that paper version. And so you'll hear more about that in the next couple of days.
Governor Gavin Newsom this morning previewing his plans for a statewide vaccine verification program, but don't call it a vaccine passport. The details are scant, but Newsom's announcement comes on the eve of California's big reopening tomorrow, when social distancing ends and vaccinated Californians can ditch their masks in most places. Businesses can still enforce their own safety measures, and unvaccinated people will still be required to wear their masks, although that's pretty much on the honor system. But the pending verification system might allow businesses to eventually check customers' vaccination status. Joining us with details is Emily Hoven at CalMatters. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's start with this vaccine verification system, not a passport. What is it?
Good question. I think no one really knows what it is. I mean, and to me, the really interesting part about this system is that, you know, the governor is taking extreme pains to say that it is not a vaccine passport. But at the end of the day, it sort of is, right? I mean, if it's something that's going to show whether or not you're vaccinated, I mean, you can call it what you want, but it is what it is. And I think part of what he's trying to stress is that it's not going to be this mandatory system. So businesses are not going to be required to opt into the system of this like technological vaccine card, but they can if they want to. What it's going to look like, how soon it's going to roll out, whether it will be free of charge, like all of these things remain unclear. And for several days, he kind of has just kept saying, you know, more details to come.
Well, I guess in the interim, businesses can just ask people for their status and for proof of their own vaccination, right?
They can ask them. They can choose to just kind of let them come in, or they can ask everybody to wear a mask and make that a condition. Or if they have their own system of verification, presumably they would be allowed to use that. You know, the state has not really given guidelines as to what sorts of like technological systems they could have or ask for. And so I think that's something that's really going to concern a lot of privacy advocates, is like, how are these systems going to work? And if different ones have different systems, are they going to be required to use the state system? It's just kind of unclear what that's going to look like. And it's crazy because the state's going to reopen tomorrow. So this is a really pressing issue.
Yeah. And so, but just as a regular person going out and about, should you just bring your vaccine card with you just in case?
I would say you should probably bring your vaccine card and your mask, because some businesses may require a mask and some may ask you for a proof of vaccination. So better to just have everything on all fronts. And that's part of the reason I think why they want this tech system, because there are a lot of anxieties around people just, you know, falsely manufacturing these vaccine cards online and selling them to people. And, you know, the attorney general, the governor's office have like put out warnings of these fraudulent cards. And so I think this online system is one way they're going to try to, you know, make sure that people are telling the truth.
Right. And so the majority of state residents have received at least one shot, right? It's like over 70% at this point.
Yeah. And 55% of eligible people have gotten fully vaccinated. You know, California is doing well, but I think at the same time, there is still anxiety for people about, you know, okay, if I go into, you know, a big event and there's a lot of people not wearing masks, I think public health experts have said there probably will be some level of uptick, which is just kind of inherent in having a lot of people mixing that haven't mixed in a long time. But the hope is that enough people have gotten at least some level of inoculation that things won't get back to, you know, a bad situation.
Okay, so let's talk about what's going to happen tomorrow. Is it just going to be like a light switch and it'll be back to pre-March?
It will be in some ways. Again, like a lot of this stuff, I think is really going to just sort of see, we're going to see what's going to happen tomorrow. But it's interesting because for the average person who's vaccinated, like, yeah, you can pretty much ditch your mask in most contexts. But if you are a worker, you cannot. And that's because the agency that regulates workplace safety and those types of rules is separate from the Department of Public Health, which is kind of just giving the general public guidelines. And so the Cal OSHA, which is the workplace safety department, they're actually meeting on Thursday to decide whether to let fully vaccinated workers ditch the masks. And the governor said today that he would actually, depending on what Cal OSHA decides, he will issue an executive order that basically brings those rules into effect that very day, because due to the intricacies of the system, they wouldn't have been able to go into effect until June 28th. But the governor said today, no, I'm going to accelerate that process so that it would happen June 17th.
Kind
of we have on that, but it's confusing. It's just confusing, you know? And it's still unclear to me how businesses are supposed to verify if their workers are vaccinated. Like, forget the customer verification system. How are they going to verify their own employees? And so there are just a lot of unanswered questions.
Right, because we were just reporting last week that the date was June 28th for workers and the new rules.
Yeah.
But now you're saying that'll be moved up to June 17th, possibly.
That's what the governor said today. Yeah. And we don't know what they're going to decide, although, you know, the governor and the health department have really been hinting strongly, hey, Cal OSHA, you better vote to update the rules. And so I think that they will, most likely. And then the governor will then make that happen as soon as possible. But the goalposts have been changing a lot. I mean, in Cal OSHA, they have honestly just been all over the place. They've already reversed themselves 3 different times. The first time they didn't even know what they were voting on, even though it was their own rule. And then at their meeting last week, it was hilarious. There was numerous board members that said, wait, what's going to happen on June 15th? And I'm like, isn't that what you're supposed to be telling us? Do you know what I mean? Like, there was just a lot of it was not clear what was going on.
That's not inspiring. Really,
yeah, exactly.
So, okay, set that aside for now, because we don't really have a clear idea about that. What about when you, for example, just go about your daily life? You're going to the store, you're going to restaurants, maybe you're going out to a concert. All of the social distancing rules, those will be gone tomorrow? There won't be those long lines outside the Trader Joe's, for example?
Yeah, I mean, again, if you're fully vaccinated, things are pretty much going to snap back to normal, except for those really large indoor events. Like, if you're having a massive indoor concert, for example, I think if you have more than 5,000 attendees, that one, the businesses are actually required to have either proof of vaccination or of a negative COVID test. So there are certain events that are going to have their own special rules. But for everything else, yeah, if you're just an average person, like, you can go about your life pretty much as normal. So it'll be kind of an interesting transition after 15 months of not doing that. You know, I feel like it's going to be a bit strange. Even for me, I reflexively just grab my mask, you know, and I'm still going to keep carrying it because certain places might require it, but it's going to be kind of an abrupt snap.
Yeah, I know. I think we're all still trying to wrap our heads around this. It's really, as you say, it is really abrupt. And I think we're going to have to see how it goes.
Yeah.
All of us are sort of playing it as it goes.
Totally. Yeah, I saw a tweet today that kind of made me laugh, where it's like, oh, yay, the pandemic is ending tomorrow, which it kind of is funny, because it's sort of like this date to a certain extent is like somewhat random. And it's sort of a reminder that, you know, things, the actual conditions themselves are not necessarily changing, but our behavior is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just, I don't know. I mean, this whole past year has been so surreal. And I think all of a sudden, you know, seeing bustling restaurants indoors and all of a sudden, like, you know, not having to stay 6 feet apart, it's kind of like, was the past year and a half a dream, you know? I don't even know what's going on. It's crazy.
You're right. We do live in surreal times. Emily, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. Great talking with you.
You too. That's Emily Hoven. She writes the What Matters newsletter on California policy and politics for Cal Matters. Well, over the weekend, a federal judge in Texas dismissed a lawsuit filed by workers at a Houston hospital who had objected to a mandatory vaccine program. The hospital required a COVID vaccine for its employees. Most of them complied, but some refused and took the hospital to court, arguing that the vaccine was untested and the vaccine mandate was not legal. It's one of the first cases of its kind as employers try to tightrope the reopening. We're going to talk about this now with Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor, and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hello.
Hello.
All right. The lead plaintiff in this case is a nurse at Houston Methodist. Her name is Jennifer Bridges, and she basically argued that she and her fellow staffers were medical guinea pigs. And in an interview that aired this morning on the Today Show, she took it a step further.
You could compare this to the very early stages of Nazi Germany.
That is a statement not to be taken lightly. Are you sure you want to make it?
Oh, yes, 100%.
Okay. Well, apparently she actually made that in her complaint. How did the judge respond?
Well, let's just say whenever somebody interviewing you says, are you sure you want to make that statement? It's a great time to take a deep breath and reflect. And the judge here probably should have told her the same thing. The judge describes this as, quote, reprehensible. This is a judge who's been on the bench a long time. I know we tend to see everything through partisan lenses, but this is a judge who was appointed by Reagan in 1985 and really smacked down this complaint and said, this is absolutely reprehensible. Do not make this comparison. And without using these words, said, we're talking about a life-saving vaccine. Let's not compare it to a genocide.
Yeah. And then he said, you have no case, pretty much, that the hospital can do that, mandate a vaccine.
He used a lot more words, but yes, Madeline, they all boil down to, you should give my students tonight the Cliff Notes version, which is, you have no case here. He said, quote, the hospital's employees are not participants in a human trial, going directly against that claim that she just made. The hospital is, quote, trying to do their business of saving lives without giving people the COVID-19 virus. And the hospital says, you're not being coerced here. You have a choice. You can work at this. The judge says, you have a choice. You can work at this hospital. If you don't want to work at this hospital, you can quit your job. But this was an all out, just absolute abolishment of everything that she claimed here in her complaint. And that's because the law is simply not on her side. And whether or not these vaccines have emergency authorization or regular authorization, what we know is the weight of the law indicates as long as you have medical exemptions and religious exemptions, you really stand on strong grounds as an employer, particularly an employer where, let's remember what she's doing. She's in a healthcare environment.
Right. Well, so I was wondering if this would be a precedent for all businesses, or is this just related to the healthcare field? But you're saying that, yes, all businesses have the right to require their employees to be vaccinated.
Well, so the EEOC came out with guidance a few months ago indicating employers, if you want to mandate vaccines, you can do so. You just have to have these exemptions for religious beliefs and for any medical issues. Now, you could run into potential legal issues if you as an employer start saying to your employees, well, I didn't think you were religious. How religious are you? When was the last time you worshiped? I'm not really sure that I trust that you need an exemption, or you look fine to me. Are you sure you have a medical issue? What's your medical issue? Let's talk about your medical issue, which is all a long way of saying, as long as employers don't go too far in terms of asking if somebody wants the exemption, why, then I do think they're on really strong footing here. Now, particularly, you asked me about the precedent. I think this case is great precedent, particularly for the healthcare setting. But if we look at, and employment laws are state by state, but if we look at what the cases have said, if we look at what employment lawyers throughout the country have said, if employers and schools, we've seen a lot of instances of higher education schools, say to anybody who's going to be back on campus, here's the deal. You want to be here. This is now contingent upon your employment, is that you get this vaccine. I really do think that these restrictions will by and large be upheld.
But I thought that was just because that they couldn't do that unless it had permanent authorization, that it was voluntary. if these drugs were still under emergency use authorization?
So I think there are a lot of private employers, particularly, and private schools who have said, come on back, whether or not it's emergency authorization use or not. Obviously we're recording this, we're live from California, and the UCs have said to their students, you can come back as long as you are vaccinated. And if you read the small print for the UCs, it does say once this goes off of emergency authorization.
Right, because it's a public university.
Exactly. So I think there's a difference there.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about this huge story developing, and news broke over the weekend, about President Trump's DOJ subpoenaing data from Apple, asking for data on House Democrats and also White House counsel Don McGahn as part of a hunt for leakers of information regarding the Russia investigation. And here's a little reaction from the weekend from California lawmakers.
What the administration did, the Justice Department, the leadership of the former president, goes even beyond Richard Nixon.
And I hope Trump supporters who fear Big Brother see that Donald Trump was the biggest brother we've ever seen.
Shocked on the one hand, not surprised on the other. It's disgraceful, but it's also such a body blow to our democracy.
Okay, so that's Congressman Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, two of the targets of these seizures of information. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course. Let's talk about the timing on this, given that all of this apparently occurred in 2017, 2018. Bill Barr didn't become Attorney General until 2019. So does he have plausible deniability here?
He does potentially have plausible deniability based on the timing. Now, somebody probably should have alerted him to an ongoing investigation if the Department of Justice protocols, if their internal guidelines were followed. One would think that at a certain point, even if these investigations, the subpoenas were issued before he came into office, that someone would say, I just want to let you know, here's some highly sensitive information, particularly because there's separation of powers issues here. When the Department of Justice subpoenas members of Congress or their families or staffers, that's the executive branch reaching into the legislative branch. And that's why there are all these procedures about having to work these subpoenas all the way up to the top of the Department of Justice, which, again, is a long way of saying one would have thought somebody would have told him at some point, just passing in the hall on the way to lunch, we want to let you know about these subpoenas.
Well, could he be in trouble legally?
I don't think he's going to face trouble legally. I think what we're looking at here is probably a question of whether the Department of Justice followed its internal guidelines, whether it followed their practices and procedures that really were put in place after the Nixon administration to try and prevent the Department of Justice acting like a political arm of a presidential campaign, or really trying to weaponize subpoenas against a president's political enemies. So I don't think that we're going to see a statute at issue where somebody says Bill Barr violated this criminal statute.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law Professor, and our regular League Legal here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Israel's new prime minister has roots here in California. We'll find out more about Naftali Bennett next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A major political shift is underway in Israel. Today marks Naftali Bennett's first full day as the country's new prime minister. He replaced Benjamin Netanyahu, whose 12 years in office made him Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Bennett's political views fall farther to the right than Netanyahu's. He once said he would do everything in his power so that the Palestinians don't have an independent state, and that he wants to annex the West Bank. But Bennett's place atop Israel's government is only thanks to a tenuous power-sharing agreement struck between eight political parties, including some on the left, a coalition that won approval from Israel's parliament yesterday by the slimmest of margins, a single vote. Here to tell us more about Naftali Bennett and what his leadership could mean for the Mideast and the United States is Yael Aronoff. She's director of the Serling Institute for Jewish Studies and Modern Israel at Michigan State University. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, this is quite a coalition. How did that come together? They must all really hate Benjamin Netanyahu.
Absolutely. So it's eight unlikely parties that came together with very different ideologies. As you mentioned, there are two parties on the center left, Meretz and Labor. There are two centrist parties, Blue and White and Yesh Atid. There are several parties on the right. And we have our first Arab-Israeli, Palestinian-Israeli party in the coalition government that's an Islamist party. So very different views within the party, but they all agreed that they wanted to oust Netanyahu. They just really couldn't take it anymore, both from people who are ideologically aligned with him and those who weren't. And those that were ideologically aligned with him, he unnecessarily alienated. He felt threatened by them and therefore distanced himself from them, threatened them, tried to tarnish their reputations, and had made had broken so many promises in the past so that when he tried to court everyone and their parties to form a new coalition, no one believed him anymore. He had reneged on promises to allow Gantz to rotate into the prime ministership in November. And he just lost the confidence of everyone. So we have eight parties with unlikely bedfellows.
Right. And so tell us more about Naftali Bennett. He used to work for Netanyahu and he had a big falling out with him. So he's one of the people Netanyahu alienated.
Yeah, he was his chief of staff from 2006 to 2008. He admired him. He even named his first son after Netanyahu's brother, who was killed in the Entebbe raid trying to successfully save hostages from the plane that had landed in Entebbe, Uganda. And so he had been close and admired Netanyahu, but they had a falling out. Netanyahu felt threatened by him. And also Netanyahu's wife, Sarah Netanyahu, plays a crucial role. And if someone comes in her disfavor, she has puts a lot of pressure on her husband to continue the distancing as well. So they wouldn't allow him to be defense minister in 2008. And he finally left them and formed his other parties. And his most recent party is the Yamina party. And he was just felt betrayed by Netanyahu and that he could no longer trust him. As you said in your introduction, in terms of trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in some ways, Naftali Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu. But I have some measured hope that things can get slightly better in the sense that the seven other parties, or at least several of the other parties, will contain him, and both the rotating, the person who will rotate to be prime minister in 2 years, Lapid, is a centrist who will be foreign minister, and he'll have veto power over any decision of Bennett's. That's the agreement they came to. So Bennett apparently won't be able to annex anything, won't be able to really continue with settlements. And because Lapid is very much wanting to expand and strengthen the relations with Jordan, with other Arab countries, and perhaps with Saudi Arabia, there's a slight possibility that perhaps from those kind of partial normalization plans with potentially with Saudi Arabia, that there could be continued freezing and some kind of openings that when he takes over 2 years from now, again, in a measured way, some slight reasons for hope on that track and other reasons domestically.
Well, is there any reason to believe that this coalition will hold at least for 2 years, or could we again see more chaos with more elections?
Yeah, I mean, that's a legitimate question because the society is very polarized. It's hanging on by one seat. We've had four elections in 2 years. And Netanyahu is going to be the opposition leader, a very vocal one, who's going to be obsessed with bringing the government down and just trying to peel off some defectors from the parties and from the coalition. So it's going to be a challenge. And often Israeli governments only last 2 years because there's often so many political parties in a very polarized society. But there's some hope that it will kind of retain stability for 4 years and allow Lapid to rotate through 2 years from now. Many of the parties of the coalition are committed to healing the country, to trying to make some changes internally. It's the first time, or one of the few times, the last time was in 2015, that the ultra-Orthodox parties are not in the coalition. So they want to make some headway in challenging the monopoly of the ultra-Orthodox about areas of conversion and things of that sort. And prayer. There's going to be $15 billion going into the Arab sector in Israel, so trying to move towards equality within the 67 borders of Israel. So that's a sign of hope. They really want to kind of heal the country and unify the country to some degree. And a lot of the political parties know that if there were going to be another election this year, they might their lot might become worse and they might get less people to vote for them. So I think there's also an incentive on their part to stick together.
Well, taking a little closer look at Naftali Bennett and his point of view in his life, his parents went to UC Berkeley and considered themselves like radical hippies, left wing at least. And then they moved to Israel before he was born and I guess became conservative, and he grew up in a conservative background?
Yeah, so they became modern Orthodox, so they became more religious, and also he became quite a nationalist, ultra-nationalist, and was head of the different settler organizations in the past too, and at one point had lived in a settlement. So certainly in that potentially could be a challenge, not only in terms of the necessity of making progress towards resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also healing the relationship with the United States as well, that, you know, that the bipartisan support for Israel certainly has been weakened to a certain extent under Netanyahu. So I think, though, that he's like Biden, perhaps, and wants to keep differences private rather than public. And as I said, Lapid, who's a centrist and is for a two-state solution, is going to have the main authority over foreign policy. And one of his main priorities is trying to heal the relationship with the Democratic Party in the United States, strengthen the relationship with Jordan, strengthen the relationship with other states in the Arab states in the region, strengthen the relationship with the Palestinian Authority to some extent. So again, there's some degree of very measured hope that Naftali Bennett's ideology will certainly be contained in this coalition.
All right. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
That's Yael Aronoff, director of the Serling Institute for Jewish Studies and Modern Israel at Michigan State University and author of the book, The Political Psychology of Israeli Prime Ministers When Hardliners Opt for Peace. Coming up, how a black woman was able to become a recording star in 1920.
It was the moment in which label heads knew that they needed to tap into the artistry and genius of black women's musicianship.
The musical revolution Mamie Smith sparked next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 1920, jazz singer Mamie Smith released a record called Crazy Blues.
I can't sleep at night. I can't eat a bite. 'Cause the man I love, he don't treat me right.
Well, Mamie Smith was the first Black female singer to record and release a blues song. And this kicked down a previously locked door for Black female artists and their fans, a door that had kept them out of the mainstream music industry. Music critic Daphne Brooks says Smith, her fans, and the rallying behind the blues artists that followed Smith's breakout success really helped pave the way for the fan armies that surround Black women artists now, more than a century later, such as Beyoncé's Beehive or Nicki Minaj's Barbs. Brooks teaches African American Studies at Yale University, and her new book is called Liner Notes for the Revolution, The Intellectual Life of Black Feminist Sound. And Daphne Brooks joins me now to talk about how Mamie Smith sparked a cultural revolution for Black music fans. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks, Madeline. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, many of our listeners might not be familiar with Mamie Smith and her music. Tell us a bit more about her.
She was a vaudeville glampus. I mean, she was hooping it on the vaudeville circuit. In the 1910s, she was an extraordinary actor as well as a vocalist in that live setting. But she had aspirations. She hooked up with a songwriter, Perry Bradford, African-American, who added his own kind of vision of being able to break through to the recording industry, which, as you mentioned in your intro, had turned its nose on to African-American popular musicians. They didn't believe, so the story went, that Black consumers were out there who would buy the blues. And so instead, they focused their attention on cutting tracks with folks like Sophie Tucker and Marian Harris, white artists, and their renditions of the quote-unquote blues. So Mamie Smith just changed the game when she partnered with Perry Bradford and they recorded Crazy Blues for OK Records, summer of 1920.
Huh. What was it about that particular song, Crazy Blues, that lit the house on fire, so to speak, and got fans so excited?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, to a certain extent, there are a lot of blues purists who would say, it's not really a blues. I mean, it sounds very little like Bessie or like Ma, the classic blues queens who followed her through the door in the subsequent
Bessie Smith
years.
And Ma Rainey?
Yes, right. I go by first names for my sisters. So yes, Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey. Yeah. So they followed her through the door, but Mamie's Crazy Blues was, you know, in many ways a kind of vaudeville. It had a kind of vaudeville aesthetic to it. And Smith was known for being able to draw on those chops from that theatrical genre in terms of, you know, being able to dip into ethnic impersonations and having, you know, a big wide arsenal of especially kind of sentimentalized feeling. So to answer your question, in some ways, it wasn't the recording itself that was, you know, the thing that lit the fuse. It was the fact that African Americans were able to hear themselves on record for the first time in a popular context. So what was being marketed as the blues was finally being inhabited by blues artists and songwriters.
Let me just play a little bit more of this song because it's got some racy lyrics at the end. Okay, so she says, get myself a gun and shoot myself a cop. I ain't had nothing but bad news. Now I've got the crazy blues.
Long before Ice-T, Body Count, and Cop Killer, right. There was Mamie Smith, you know?
What was the reaction to that lyric?
You know, I think that there was a general groundswell of energy around these kinds of voicings of anxiety, fear, and rage directed at a police state that had subjugated Black peoples, as we know. We have to remember that this recording breaks the year after Red Summer, right, in which cities all across the country are lit up, race massacres. So there's a way in which Perry Bradford and Mamie Smith were collaborating in order to give voice to that kind of, you know, widespread communal angst, existential questions about the ways in which police brutality would bear down on African-American folks' lives. But in terms of documenting the kind of you know, what we would think of today in the digital era as likes and Black Twitter. We didn't have that. So there are some archival gaps in terms of the reactions from African-American communities. On the record business side, we don't have any documentation as far as we can tell of label heads being anxious about that lyric, which is fascinating. What they were looking at were the numbers, the fact that Mamie Smith was able to move so many units in such a short period of time after the release of the recording later that year.
And who was buying that recording? Was it mainly Black audiences, or did it cross over?
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, right. What we think of as crossover means something a little bit different now. It was definitely a record that we know, we have numbers for, we're selling out of various merchant shops in Black communities across the country, and especially the Northeast. But you did have white consumers as well. And some of that is documented in the Black press as well as the white press during that period of time. So we could call it, you know, an early crossover smash, although the ways that we understand kind of segregated listening communities is a little bit different now.
And so after this smash, what happens? How does that change the business for Black artists?
It was the moment in which label heads knew that they needed to tap into the artistry and genius of Black women's musicianship. So a flurry of signings of, you know, all of the greats that we were mentioning earlier, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ethel Waters, Ida Cox. I mean, you have to remember that many of these people had been working the theatrical and juke joint circuits for over a decade plus. Someone like Ma Rainey, who's, you know, coming out of the South, coming out of Georgia, playing tent shows. I mean, she is a hardcore, stone cold veteran by the time that Mamie Smith has her hit, right? So she ends up coming into the recording studio after Bessie Smith, her protege, once she makes it up into the North in order to cut these records. In a way, modern culture was catching up with what was already a phenomenon in Black vernacular culture, decades in the making. If we keep in mind, especially, that blues music is the music of emancipated peoples, right? It's you know, Angela Davis has written about this in her groundbreaking book, The Ways in Which We Can Pay Attention to, and Toni Morrison too, pay attention to the fact that a newly emancipated people is laying claim to being able to articulate their own kinds of desires, choose their own partners, create their own domestic intimacies. And so this music, you know, predates 1920, you know, by many decades, but this is the moment when it becomes a national phenomenon that the dominant culture actually decides they want to care about for all sorts of lucrative reasons.
Right. And so then that also encourages Black women, as you note, to buy records, to go to record stores, which were really not considered their provenance, not considered places where they were invited to be or allowed to be.
Yes. I mean, this is something that, you know, different folks have asked me about. You know, how can you prove that Black women were actually listening to these records, women and girls? And one of my colleagues, Elijah Wald, and I have talked about the fact that, and Angela Davis notes this too, that the lyrics themselves were hailing, you know, women listeners. You know, these are stories about romance and heartbreak. They also cover the territory of social critique, but we know and can document the ways in which so many Black women were invested in this music because they saw and heard themselves in it. As for the record store itself, I mean, this is kind of a weird cultural phenomenon, a site that's beloved by me, someone who grew up in the Bay Area going to Tower Records in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, moment of silence for Tower Records.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, but this was a kind of cultural site that grew out of an investment in trying to sell records. So, you know, the stores kind of caught up with the phenomenon of the recording industry. And you had a number of African-American owned stores in different parts of the country, everywhere from Dallas to Kansas City to Los Angeles on Central Avenue. We know that women were there. And I will say, too, that there's one of the public historians, brilliant sister in Detroit, who goes by the name Marsha Music and grew up in her father's legendary record shop, Joe Van Bottles. Jo Van Baddel's music shop, she talks about, you know, growing up working in the store and seeing Black women come in, and they were especially pointed about what they were looking for, the exact song. They knew all of the details about the musicians. And it was a way in telling me this story of trying to recuperate the fact that, you know, Black women care about this history too and are deeply invested in it.
Hmm. Well, so draw a line then from that to, as I mentioned in the intro, the fandom around Black women artists, like Nicki Minaj's Barbs, for example, which, you know, to note is not just Black women who are part of this fandom.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've seen, I chart it from the moment that there was a white ingenue actress on David Letterman in the late 90s who came on and was gushing about Lauryn Hill. And I felt like it was the first time I'd seen a white teenage girl in my era just kind of go off about the iconicity of a Black woman artist. We know this to be true long before that, you know, the breakthroughs of Aretha. Mm-hmm. And many folks before her, but there is a way that these icons, of course, cross boundaries, which is why they occupy that space. But one of the things that I was really interested in trying to tell the story about in my book and in my research is how important these artists were in the ways that Black women fans, Black women and girl fans, could create these kinds of conversations with the artists, their testimonials. We have so much work now on everyone from, of course, Queen Beyoncé to Mary J. Blige, and the ways that their narrative testimonies lay claim to, you know, a kind of representation of everyday Black women's interiority in the public sphere. And that really does date back to the classic blues queens. You know, they were able to make Black women's interior desires something of a cultural phenomenon and something to be regarded with care and with awe. And that meant, of course, so much to Black women fans, Black women and girl fans, especially if we know the cinematic story of representation is very different, right? So where are you going to be able to see yourself? You're maybe going to hear yourself before you see yourself in this kind of a context.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what happened with Mamie Smith after this big hit? Was she a one-hit wonder?
I think we would now call her a one-hit wonder. She did very well for herself, though. You know, she continued to perform in live spaces across the Midwest and the Northeast. You know, she lived a kind of a life of financial security relative to other African Americans of that period. So it's not the kind of tragic story that we often attach to a number of blues queens, including Bessie Smith, everyone from Bessie Smith to Billie Holiday, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Daphne, thank you so much for coming on the show today. That was fascinating.
Absolutely. Here's to Mamie Smith.
Here's to Mamie Smith. Daphne Brooks from Yale University. She's author of the new book, Liner Notes for the Revolution, The Intellectual Life of Black Feminist Sound. Coming up, how the Calm Meditation app became a $2 billion phenomenon during the pandemic. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Calm, a feeling a lot of us probably haven't felt in a while, given, well, you know, the last 16 months. Our collective anxiety has been a boon for Calm, the meditation app, though. Open the app and you are transported to a lake set in the middle of a mountain range with the sound of tiny waves lapping the shore. That has helped make Calm one of the most successful apps, valued at around $2 billion. So how did an app based on a product that really anyone can do for free build one of the biggest wellness empires out there? Annie Lowry wrote about this for The Atlantic and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you tried it. Did it calm you?
You know, meditation, it does work. I'm like, no, I'm a terribly uncalm And it would be ridiculous for me to sit here and be like, yes, I'm a paragon of Zen. But I do think that it helps on the margin. I am a meditator, if not always a consistent one, which I think probably describes a lot of us. But it does help. The mindfulness, I think, does help in giving you that little bit of space between, incoming stimulus and sort of automatic reaction.
Right. And it's not hard to do. You sit in a quiet place. You breathe, you try not to think about things.
Yeah,
and there
exactly.
You have it, pretty much.
Right, there's this like joke about meditation, don't just do something, sit there. There's lots of ways to do it. There's no one right way of doing it. There's tons of different practices, spiritual practices, kind of science-based practices. But yeah, the idea is that you sit there and you focus on your breath and you try to observe your mind as it's cogitating in at least a lot of cases. I wouldn't want to generalize completely because, again, it's a complicated and big world out there in terms of sitting and doing nothing.
Right. And meditation has been around for a long, long, long time, hundreds and hundreds of years. And so how does Calm, the app, come along and turn it into this multi-billion dollar enterprise?
It's interesting because, as you point out, it doesn't cost anything. You don't have to do anything. You can just, and I think a lot of people who meditate do just sit there with their eyes closed or sit there just looking at a point in space. And, maybe you use a timer or maybe you don't, maybe you just count your breaths or maybe you do nothing. But where I think Calm and some of its competitors like 10% Happier or Headspace help is that they make the practice a little bit less daunting because you're basically putting on, it's like the equivalent of a little song or a little video on your smartphone. And it tells you what to do. It keeps the timer for you and then it tracks your progress. So it is in some ways a little bit less scary than just trying to sit there and do it yourself or perhaps reading a book. And, and I think for a lot of folks who might have had interest in this, there's plenty of ways to go meditate in person with teachers or in a sangha or another group. But a lot of that was not possible or harder to do during the pandemic.
Right. So the pandemic was a big boon for Calm, I guess.
Yeah, for all meditation apps, it was a absolutely giant boon. So Calm's downloads spiked by about a third, and many of its competitor companies saw significant increases as well. I think a lot of wellness businesses did really well, especially those that let people do things in the privacy of their own home.
And how much of it has to do with the name? Like, it just sounds good to have to download some Calm. So why not?
I think it, yeah. And it's a nice looking app is the thing I would say. It's very easy to use. It's not daunting. And this is something that the founders of it, who are both sort of tech guys, they're not wellness or mindfulness or certainly not experts in Buddhism or Hinduism or another kind of spiritual or religious practice that involves meditation, they said that they wanted to make it such that you wouldn't have to know anything going in. They don't use a lot of terminology that experienced practitioners or one who are coming from a religious or spiritual background might use. They want it to be accessible to everybody, instantly accessible.
Right. But you do pay, right? It's not free.
Oh, yeah. They have free content, but no, it is like $15 a month, or you can pay $70 for a year or $400 for lifetime access. And that's a pretty similar price to a lot of its competitors. Though I would note that there's a ton of free resources for folks who want to meditate out there. It's not something that you have to pay for, even if you do want an app or a video or something like that to track your progress. But it is a nice, it's kind of a luxury feeling meditation experience. It's a really pretty app. It's really, again, pretty simple. And I think that that's one of the things that people are attracted to. And one other way that these companies have grown a lot is through corporate partnerships. So this is a way that companies can offer this to their employees that might make those employees, a little bit happier, a little bit calmer, a little bit more productive at work. And so they've really expanded in that way, too.
Well, how is Calm expanding into other areas? It apparently is becoming a wellness empire with blankets and puzzles and cushions and all sorts of products you can buy to be calm.
Oh, goodness. Yes, it is rapidly expanding. So it has all kinds of paraphernalia. A lot of it is made through partnership with other companies. So yeah, like meditation cushions and that kind of thing. And then Calm has moved into this space of helping people sleep through kind of sleep music and sleep stories. So sort of like bedtime stories for adult type things. They've moved into making soothing television content. So you can watch these kind of beautifully narrated sort of nature or space type docs that they created. And then the two guys who created the company have even talked about creating like in-person spas or resorts, right? A kind of like meditative Disney World is the way that they describe it. And on top of that, they've also put meditation content on things like airplanes and in the back of Uber rides, that sort of thing. So yes, it's creeping into all sorts of aspects of modern late capitalist life here.
How unironic. Anyway, Annie Lowry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Annie covers economic policy for The Atlantic. A very calm job indeed. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow. Deep breaths.